sort of the historical context of the Jewish battle against Amalek and how that particularly manifested itself in Shaul's failure. It's a failure of catastrophic significance in terms of his monarchy and his dynasty. And what I'd like to try to do tonight is to look at really a characterological comparison of the figures of Esther and Shaul. I'm not the first person to think of this comparison. In fact, the rabbis of the Talmud already sort of compared them. They saw certain characteristics that were parallel between these two figures, between Shaul and Esther. Esther being a descendant of Shaul. In fact, Mordechai takes care of Esther and raises her as a surrogate father, ki ein lo avaim, because her parents died. Mordechai is described, Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish Ishimini from the tribe of Binyamin, the same tribe as Shaul. And I want to try to use the confrontation with Amalek that both Shaul and Esther respectively experienced as a kind of a litmus test for growth in character or shrinking in character. We already described how Shaul was not able to live, to rise to that occasion, to that moment. And in fact, Amalek becomes his very undoing, both his failure in the battle against Amalek and then in the literal sense, the very end of his life after Shaul is grievously and gravely wounded in battle against the Plishtim. He actually requests that he will be physically killed by an Amaleki who happens to be passing by, so the Plishtim aren't able to get to him, are not able to get to his body. But there's something highly significant about that. So what I want to try to do tonight is sort of first to trace the parallels and see the extent to which Shaul and Esther had a very similar disposition. And yet Amalek is kind of that fork in the road where Shaul goes one way, Esther goes the opposite direction. And it's almost like a new character emerges in the personality of Esther that Shaul could never achieve. Okay? So first of all, there's a number of important linguistic similarities that certainly the Megillah was playing off of. We noted that when Shaul lost the kingdom, the Navi used the expression, you have it here in the first source, Vayomer Lav Shmuel, Kara Adonai et Mamlechut Yisrael Me'alecha Hayom, Untana l'reyacha hatov mimecha. That the Lord of Israel has taken away the kingdom from you and has given it over to reyacha hatov mimecha. Okay, reyacha meaning your fellow who is more suited, who is better, who is more fit for the position than you are. L'reyacha hatov mimecha. In the very first chapter of the book of Esther, you have that exact expression in the feminized version when Mimulchan, a very shady character from the first chapter, the Megillah, who gives Achashverosh particularly inane advice and very ironic advice because he says, you know, in defying you by not coming, Vashti is not only in rebellion against you, but he's going to set an example, you know, that all the women in the kingdom are going to defy their husbands and they're going to do as they please. And therefore, we have to crack down on her. We have to make sure that we show everybody who's boss, the Yos Kol Ish. So, I say ironic, because the entire story of the Megillah is about how Esther ends up running the palace and not Achashverosh. So it wasn't exactly come to pass. But be that as it may, the Pasuk says, you have it here in the second source, okay, it will be given over to the one who is better than she is. But in saying better than Vashti is, there's also a little bit of an expression and a little bit of an insinuation back to those words, L'reyacha tov mimecha, that not only is Esther, we haven't met her yet, better than Vashti, or more suited than Vashti, but she's actually more suited than Shaul was for a position of Malchus. That's what we're going to try to develop tonight. So, as I mentioned, the rabbis themselves were deeply sensitive to the characterological and personality similarities between Shaul and Esther, especially in terms of that most noble feature that Shaul was able to manifest in so many different ways, which was his modesty. Right? We know that Shaul didn't go around telling anybody that Shmuel had anointed him as king. At his own inauguration ceremony, he is Nechba el Hakilim. He hides, he doesn't want to be singled out. When individuals are very disparaging towards him, again, one could be critical of all these things in the opposite direction, that he's not taking a leadership position, but on the positive side, when individuals disparage him, he fits the rabbi's description of ne'elavin ve'enan olvin, shomim cherpasan ve'enan neshivin, that people can insult him, he doesn't have to respond in kind, he doesn't get involved in the pettiness, etc. So the Gemara Masechta Megillah Daf Yud Gimel notes that, you know, Shaul and Esther had a very similar personality in that sense. That Esther, as we know, didn't reveal about herself where she was from. And the rabbis very astutely noted that that reminds us a lot of Shaul, right, her ancestor. Amar Rabbi Lazar, my dechsev lo yigarami tzadik enav, bischar tzniyo shahaisa ba berachel. The modesty that was characteristic of Rachel. Rachel, of course, who's the mother of Binyamin and Yosef altogether. Mimena, yatsa mimena Shaul, v'schar tzniyo shahayabo v'sha'ul. The modesty of Shaul manifests itself later. Zacha v'yatsas mimenu Esther. So he merited being a direct ancestor of Esther. Lefikach, zachta v'yatsa mimenu Shaul, masniyo shahayisa v'sha'ul. What was Shaul's great modesty? Dechsev. Remember when Shaul comes back after searching for the donkeys, and meanwhile he's anointed the future leader of the Jewish people, his uncle says, you know, basically what's been going on, and Shaul says, yeah, you know, we were looking for the donkeys. As Devar HaMelucha Lo Higidlo. He didn't say, oh, and by the way, I was appointed to be the next leader of the Jewish people. That's what we call burying the lead in the field. You know, he was not willing to be public about that. Asher Amar Shmuel, Zacha v'yatsan menu Esther. So he merited having Esther, who would be extremely modest and private. Now again, Esther's modesty is not just with respect to the fact that she keeps things to herself, but it's the reason that she keeps things to herself. So as the Megillah tells us, so quite remarkably about Esther, that just as Esther did what it was that Mordechai told her to do when she was just a child, being raised, an orphan child, being raised in his home, so too Esther acted when she was the queen in the palace itself. Now this may seem like a relatively innocuous kind of a statement, but it's actually a very dramatic statement, because how many people are unchanged by that power? But the Megillah testifies to it. Ve'es ma'amar Mordechai Esther osa kasher hayta ve'amna ito. That she was the same person as queen as she was as a girl in Mordechai's house. That itself tells you something about her. Moreover, if you look here in the text in the second chapter, we're told that all of the women who were part of this project that Ahasuerus had, project a euphemistic term for what he was doing, okay, searching for the new queen, all the women were attempting to, you know, somehow present themselves to Ahasuerus in the best way possible, that there was something attractive to them about this position. Now again, that may have been foolish on their part. They should have looked at, you know, people who held the position previously. That should have given them an indication of the position. But be that as it may, right, the Megillah testifies, Ace kol asher tomar yinatein la lavo ima mi beis hanashim ad beis hamelech. That all the women were able to request whatever it was they wanted for the sake of making themselves more attractive for the position of queen. Uvihagia tor ester bat avichai do Mordechai lavo el hamelech. But when it was Esther's turn, it was something completely different. Lo viksha davar. She didn't ask for anything. Which reflects really two things about her. Again, a deep kind of a modesty to her, where she wasn't looking somehow to make herself more attractive for the position. And second of all, a certain sense of what I would call deeper modesty, recognition that this entire, this hardly the words to describe what Ahasuerus was doing in actuality, but that there was something revolting about this entire process. That there was something horrific about Ahasuerus seizing married and unmarried women from all over the kingdom, right, without giving them a choice, to sort of give them a tryout, as it were, to become queen. That Esther wanted no part of this. And part of that was her passivity, a kind of a passive resistance. Lo viksha davar. If she's forced to be here, she's forced to be here. But the expression in the Talmud comes to mind when the Gemara is describing Esther's involvement with Ahasuerus in a more intimate sense. They say Esther karka olam haisa, that Esther was completely non-active in terms of her relationship with Ahasuerus. And this is part of that, right? That Esther did not seek the position. Esther did not seek to make herself more attractive to Ahasuerus. So there's that retiring aspect to her, and I think a retiring aspect to her that reflects a certain moral clarity about her, even at this early stage, very much reminiscent of the kind of modesty and retiring, reserved nature that was very much the province of Shaul. Now, as we know, the trouble with Shaul is that when he has to assert himself as the king, he's unable to do so, and he admits, as we studied last week, to Shmuel, that he was unable to lead the people. Ki areisi es ha'am, because I feared the nation, and I therefore listened to their voices. You can't have it both ways. You can't both listen to God and listen to the people. You can't both lead the people and be led by the people. So Amalek becomes that point at which it's clear that Shaul is not cut out for this position. So says Shmuel, hello, im katona tabe inecha. You want to be as modest as you want. And the same words could have been said later on to Esther. Hello, im katona tabe inecha. Rosh shivtei Yisrael ata. So Shmuel gives Shaul that speech, and it's too late. And Shaul, of course, loses the monarchy. And Esther gets a very similar speech, because what happens is she's also given a mission against Amalek of a different sort. And she too says, I'm afraid. I'm unable to carry out this mission. Because after all, you know the rules. The king hasn't called me in 30 days. If I go in unannounced and the king is not in the right mood, so then I'm going to die. In other words, she says what Shaul said, that is, quite simply, I am afraid. And Mordechai, playing the role of Shmuel, says, well, you might be afraid, but too bad. Umi yodeya im le'ez kazos yigad l'malchus. God puts you in this position. Hello, im katona taveinecha roshiv te Yisrael ata. You want to be as modest as you want between you and yourself, that's fine. But that the position does not allow for this kind of a reaction. And unlike Shaul, Esther undergoes this incredible transformation and flowering of character. So if you take a look with me here, at the fourth source, Vatomer Esther lehashiva Mordechai, and so Esther says to Mordechai, sends the message, and she uses all of a sudden this imperative language: Leich, go, Kenosis kol Yehudim anim tzim b'shushan, gather the Jews, Vitzumu alai, and I want you to fast for me. V'al tochlu v'al tishtu shloshes yamim laila v'yom. She's giving a command to the entire nation, 72 hours. Gaman even arosayatum kain, and I of course will fast as well. V'chein avol amelach asher lo chadas, and I will violate protocol in coming to the king. V'chasher avadati avadati, and if that is my end, so shall it be my end. V'yavor Mordechai, v'yas kechol asher tzivta alav Esther. Who is now the one issuing the tzivui, the command? Esther. So Esther went from being passive, lo viksha davar. Esther went from listening to whatever Mordechai said, vet ma'amar Mordechai Esther osa, kasher ayta v'amnaito. She goes to being a figure who's ready to assume leadership. Halon katona tabeinecha roshiv te yisralata. What Shaul never internalized, Esther, who had such a similar makeup to Shaul, is able to use this moment of crisis to find and discover something within herself that had never been manifest before. Umalchusa yitein amelech lirutaha tova mimena, very much echoing that she was greater than Shaul. She found something within herself that Shaul could not find. And she overcame her own fears. In the beginning of the fifth chapter, it's so beautiful that on the third day we're told, Vatilbash Esther Malchus, that she literally adorned herself in monarchy. Not just in the clothes of monarchy, but with a sense of royalty about her. With a kind of a sense of leadership that reflects a certain intangible. And it's not just, as we know, that she's able to orchestrate everything and get Haman to be hanged and bring Mordechai into a position of influence and power, but we're told in the eighth chapter when the situation is still far from clear. Because remember, Ahasuerus has not agreed to rescind the decree against the Jews. So what we're told here at the beginning of the fifth chapter is Vatosef Esther. And Esther carried on further, they would say today, and yet she persisted. Nonetheless, she persisted. Vatosef Esther, she persisted. Vatidaber lifnei hamelech, vatipol lifnei raglav. And she cries, and she gets him to try, you know, she's appealing that he should remove the evil of Haman and the letters that were originally sent to destroy the Jewish people. And she's able to get part of the way there, which is permission at least to send the message that the Jewish people should be allowed to defend themselves. So again, there's a sense of now Esther doesn't need to be... Mordechai's not telling her, oh Esther, go and do this. He's not giving her the script. Vatosef Esther, she's able to move on her own. She's able to seize the initiative. Okay? Next instance of this. You know, the king who, you know, and again, this takes us back to the first chapter, when the great thing to be concerned about is, you know, the women, that the women are going to denigrate their husbands, they're not going to listen, they're going to become all uppity and, you know, decide what to do. So that's exactly, of course, what happens to Ahasuerus, because Esther ends up, you know, being the one in a position where, you know, Ahasuerus is drinking and Esther is actually getting things done and calling the shots. And Esther goes to the king and she says, I want another day of fighting. I want another day of fighting in capital city of Shushan. Now the king was very angry about what happened. Vayomer HaMelech, this is the sixth source. Le'Esther HaMalka B'Shushan HaBira Hargu HaYudim V'Abed Chamesh Meos Ish. There's already been bloodshed in the city. V'Eis HaSeres Bnei Haman B'Shar Medinos HaMelech Me'asu. Okay, what's going to happen in the rest of the provinces of the king? But then U'ma She'latech V'Natein Lach U'ma Pachashatech Od V'Teas. Whatever you want, we're going to do. Okay? So the Gemara comments on this and says, what happens in the middle of the Pasuk? Ahasuerus started out so angry about the first day of fighting in Shushan. 500 people were killed, and now Esther wants another day of fighting? And so the Gemara says it was as if a malach came and smacked Ahasuerus in the middle of the Pasuk. But what it really is, in terms of the Pshat, is Ahasuerus looks up, and what happens? He's intimidated by her. He's initially upset about all the bloodshed that's going on in Shushan. Right? He doesn't want people in the capital city to be all upset. But he looks at her and he sees her determination. And he says, okay, Esther, whatever you want. Again, exact reverse of chapter 1. When Leos Kolish Sober Bebeso, I don't know what was going on in anybody else's house, but Ahasuerus was certainly not Sober Bebeso. That's for sure. That we can say. Okay? Vatomer Esther. And so Esther says, so what does Esther say? We need another day of fighting. An extra day of fighting in Shushan. Why? It's the capital city. And we need to make sure that there are no cells left in the capital city of anti-Semites, of people who could cause danger, underground cells. And so she spends another day rooting out the last 300 of those who would seek to harm the Jews. And what does she do? It's a drastic step. Normally the Torah wouldn't even allow this. So she takes the dead bodies of the 10 sons of Haman and she displays them on the tree. Let it be known that anybody who tries to fight against the Jews, that this will be their fate. This is a very dramatic and public statement of a very bold woman at this point, who's making a very strong statement about the individual whom the king himself had elevated, and this individual and his family. And again, Mordechai is not giving her instructions. This is Esther on her own, sensing what it is that the hour required. And think about that transformation. From Ve'esmamar Mordechai Esther Osa, that Esther simply following what it was that Mordechai told her to do. Ein Esther Magedes Esama Ve'esmodalata Kasher Tziva La Mordechai, to the point where she gives Mordechai commandments, and then beyond that, when she's just on her own, instinctively, intuitively sensing what it is that the hour requires, right? And making sure that there's going to be an extra day of fighting in Shushan, making sure that the bodies of the sons of Haman are going to be displayed, because a point needs to be made, a message needs to be sent to the entire kingdom, okay? And for that reason, we still have Shushan Purim. Now, then the ninth chapter, which is in some ways the most fascinating chapter, goes on to describe that Mordechai had initially, you know, called on the Jews of the empire to continue to celebrate this day, to remember what it was that happened. And the Jews had agreed. But like many things, that with time, it began to fade. And so we're told here at the very end of the ninth chapter, this is very close to the end of the Megillah entirely, Vatichtov Esther HaMalkah. But it's not an accident that she's referred to here as Esther HaMalkah, right? In the royal sense, Bat Avichayil Mordechai Yudiyat Kol Tokef V'Kayem Esigeres HaPurim HaZos HaShinis. They send out a second letter, again, trying to reaffirm the celebration and the establishment of Purim as a holiday, something that was unprecedented, something that had never happened before, the addition of a rabbinic holiday. V'Yishlach Sfarim Al Kol HaYudim. This is, of course, before Hanukkah. Al Sheva v'yasim meyam dina malchus achashverosh divrei shalom v'emes l'kayem esimei hapurim ha'ela bizmanehem, that they should fulfill these holidays of Purim in their times, meaning everybody on the 14th, the walled cities on the 15th, because of course Esther had asked for that extra day of fighting in Shushan. Hasher kiyam aleihem Mordechai Yudiv Esther Malkah v'chasher kimol nafsham v'alzaram divrei atzmos v'zakasam. And then the very last verse of the ninth chapter tells us, Uma'amar Esther, Kiyam Divrei HaPurim Ha'ela, V'nichtav Basefer. What caused Purim to be observed as a holiday? It was whose letter? Not Mordechai's, but Esther's. Kiyam Divrei HaPurim Ha'ela, the Malbim explains, this is a reference to the observance of the holiday of Purim. V'nichtav Basefer, this is a reference to the inclusion of the book of Esther in Tanakh itself. So that Esther was responsible for the dual establishment of the day, Purim as a holiday, and the inclusion within the biblical canon of the book of Esther. We don't call it Megillat Mordechai or Megillat Purim. It's Megillat Esther. It's her story. It's the story of somebody who by nature was retiring, was understated, was reserved, was quiet, who when she came to the crossroads that was Amalek, unlike her ancestor Shaul, who shrank from it, ki yaresi es ha'am va'eshma b'kolam, where she's able to find and discover something within herself, something assertive, something powerful, something intuitive, that Shaul was not able to discover within himself. And therefore she is re'uta ha'tova mimena. She is the one who is greater than the one who came before her. Not just Vashti, of course, but really Shaul. The Gemara tells it in very dramatic terms. There's no other way to say it. Here we have it in the seventh source. Shalcha lahem Esther lechachamim. Esther sent to the rabbis of that day. So it's not just Esther standing up against Haman, Esther standing up against Achashverosh, but Shalcha lahem Esther lechachamim. Kiva'uni ledoros. Establish me and my story as a holiday for all generations. So the rabbis were very hesitant. They were afraid. Shalchulah. So they said to her, Kina atno reres aleinu levein ha'umos. You're going to cause anti-Semitism. If we turn this into a holiday, they'll think that we're celebrating our, you know, military victory over them. It's going to be a source of anti-Semitism. Shalchulahem. So her response is, Kvar k'suva ani al divrei hayamim l'malchei madayu faras. My story is already known. Don't pretend as if we're going to be the only ones to say it, and therefore there's going to be anti-Semitism. If somebody wants to be angry at the Jews over what happened, they're going to be angry at the Jews over what happened. But it's important for us to remember. It's important for us
to have these days to celebrate. And once again, it wasn't just a matter of the holiday.
Esther sent to the rabbis of her generation and she said, I want my story to be written down for all generations. And so the response was, no, we can't write you down. The battle against Amalek is already recorded in Sefer Shmos and Sefer Devarim. In the Navi Shmuel that we read this past Shabbos as the Haftorah for Parsha Zachar, Kvar kasavti lecha shileishim, shileishim below ribeim.
We don't have any more room for the story of yet another battle against Amalek. But then the rabbis went back and they checked and they saw that indeed she was correct. Ad shamatu la mikra kasu, ksob zos yikaran masefer v'simba aznei Yoshua, ksob zos mashakasav kanu mishnah Torah, zikaran mashakasav neviim, masefer mashakasav megillah. That is to say that Esther's assertiveness, right, was not limited to the story and the plot of the Megillah itself in confronting Achashverosh, in confronting Haman, in even giving Mordechai instructions and imperatives in terms of what he needed to do, Lech Kenosis Kol HaYehudim, but that Esther's assertiveness expressed itself even with the rabbinic establishment of her generation, saying, you have to appreciate how important this story is. You have to appreciate why this needs to be in the canon. You have to appreciate what these days represent and why these days need to be the first days that we ever have that aren't included in the Torah but that are going to be marked as holidays on an annual basis. And she was successful in all of these levels. And not only that, but she was so impressive in her stature that it was the force of her personality. Umamar Esther, Kiyam es divrei apurim ha'ela v'nichtav ba'sefer. It was Esther's force of personality that ultimately was responsible for the fact that Purim was observed as a holiday by the people in her generation and for all successive generations to come. The days of Purim, of course, unique amongst the holidays. We have a tradition that even if all the other holidays somehow become nullified, Yimei HaPurim Ha'ela Lo Yavru Mitoch HaYudim V'Zichram Lo Yasuf Mizaram, that the holiday of Purim will somehow be able to last and survive. And that's a whole discussion in its own right, but it's all due to the personality of Esther. So the real point that I wanted to try to get across is the internal irony of the Megillah, which we spoke about, how chapter 1 is all about how the man is going to be in charge of the house and Esther ends up being the one who's in charge of everything. Okay, that's number one. So it's like an internal irony in the Megillah, which is why lehalacha we say that even if women generally are exempted from mitzvahs asei shazman grama, positive time-bound commandments, when it comes to all the mitzvahs associated with Purim, women are of course obligated because the Gemara says afen hayu ba'oso adei. Some people says, well, they too would have been killed by Haman. But the simpler interpretation of that is that Esther was of course the one who was the catalyst for the miracle of the entire Purim story. Okay, so that's a point number one to reflect on. But point number two, and this is just an absolutely critical point, is the contrast that we've been studying. We've been studying a lot about the personality of Shaul through the first 15 chapters of Sefer Shmuel, and seeing how, when sometimes people get to a certain point, they come to a moment in time, and either they are able to somehow reach that moment, or that moment reveals that they simply aren't fit for the place in which, the position in which they find themselves. And that's the story of Shaul. His confrontation with Amalek reveals that he is not the true material of the king. And that's why God says, as we studied last week, Nichamti kimlachti et Shaul lemelech. Sense of deep remorse and regret, because Shaul simply doesn't have what it takes to lead the people. He instead fears them and he's led by them. And then you have other people. And Esther is the direct descendant of Shaul, so the comparison is right there to be had. And it's the same confrontation with Amalek, and it's the same initial character of a retiring person. It's the same initial response that I'm afraid, I can't move forward with this, because what's the king going to do to me? And yet she's able to find within herself something that didn't exist before. And so as we go into Purim, of course, first with Tanis Esther on Wednesday, then going into the Megillah on Thursday, this is a key theme that has to be on our minds. That sometimes life challenges us and calls us to find something within ourselves that we weren't required to display before, perhaps that we didn't even know was there. because the situation requires it. Umiyodeya im leis kazos higat lemalchus. Esther didn't go looking around, like unlike every other woman who was doing everything in her power to audition for the position of queen and requesting all kinds of cosmetics and whatever it was that would distinguish her, right? Lo diksha davar. She didn't want any part of it. Right? She was repulsed by the entire enterprise, but she found herself in this position, and she knew if I am in this position, then I must do something from this position. And that story, which happens to be the story of an orphan girl in Persia, of a displaced people dealing with a protracted period of exile, the first exile in Jewish history, Churban Bayit Rishon, that story at once takes place within a very specific historical context, but it is a story for all generations because it is a story about self-discovery. It's a story about self-actualization, how a person can find within themselves, when confronted with an external challenge, something that they simply didn't know existed before. And when they're able to discover that about themselves, then they're able to deliver an entire nation from the brink of utter disaster and annihilation. But it starts with one person discovering something about herself. And when she's able to find that strength within herself, everything starts to fall into place. She has, of course, has to believe that God will be helping her. Lech kenosis kol hayudim anim tzim bishushan v'tsumu alai, fast and pray. But she also had to believe in herself. And Shaul never really believes in himself in that way. He never really believes that he belongs. And if a person doesn't believe in this world that they belong where they are, they can never be successful, no matter what the position is. And when Esther is convinced that she belongs exactly where she is, that this is where God wanted her to be, she realizes that nothing can stop her. Not Achashverosh, not Haman, not whatever the etiquette, Asher Lo Chadas, whatever the etiquette of the Persian palace really was. And even to a certain extent, right, when the rabbis of her generation said, oh, we can't write it down, it's anti-Semitism, we're not going to be able to celebrate this holiday, she saw that perhaps they should look again. There's a kind of an assertiveness there that we can only but admire. A sense that this is an important message for all generations. This is, of course, the story, the final chapter in the story. Ksov zos zikaron basefer. Basefer, that's the story of Esther's confrontation with Amalek when she discovered something within herself and was able to deliver her entire generation. Yimei ha-purim ha-ela lo yavru mitoch ha-yehudim. V'zichram lo Yosef mizaram, that the memory of Purim will always be with us. Of course, it's not Megillat Purim, it's not Megillat Mordechai, it's Megillat Esther. It's really her story. And in her story, hopefully, we find the strength that she found within herself. We find the strength that's relevant to each and every one of our own lives to be able to do all that which is in our power to maximize our potential and to serve the community around us. So God willing, after Purim, starting on Monday next week until Pesach, what we'll have is a little bit of a break from the regularly scheduled program of Sefer Shmuel, but we'll speak in different ways about the Haggadah each and every week. We'll pick a different section to develop as we prepare Shloshim Yom Kodem Achag, 30 days before Pesach, Sholin V'Dorshin B'Hilchos Achag. So as is the tradition, we'll involve ourselves in study of the laws of Pesach and try to prepare ourselves as best as possible. It's hard to believe, but Pesach will soon be upon us, Purim this week, and then moving right on to Pesach. So the times, they are a-changing. Thank you very much.